This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehias Wuhib in Washington. Here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Whose life must we lose? We can't protect the lives of the frontline workers. Instruments that are required and necessary for them to protect their lives are not provided.
That's Zola Sapeta, General Secretary for South Africa's National Education, Health and Allied Workers Union, on plans for protests and a possible strike by health workers. Details coming up also. A ceasefire has been announced between the warring Libyan factions today. And in Mali, the UN says it has gained access to Mali's ousted president. All these and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. Libya's warring factions announced a ceasefire today, raising hopes that their stalemated civil war could end and give the battered country a chance to recover and stabilize. The UN-supported Government of National Accord in Tripoli and the rival parliament in the east issued similar statements. Concerns have been rising that the conflict could escalate in a battle over Sirte, the gateway to the country's major oil export terminals. The UN's top official to Libya, Stephanie Williams, called for all parties to rise to this historic occasion and shoulder their full responsibilities before the Libyan people. Previous efforts to secure lasting ceasefire have stalled, and the conflict has been complicated because each side has other countries backing it, spawning a proxy war. Libya was plunged into chaos when a NATO-backed uprising in 2011 toppled longtime dictator Muammar Gaddafi, who was later killed. In Mali, the United Nations said today it has gained access to the West African country's ousted president, while rebel soldiers announced the release of two other leaders held since a coup this week. Nicolas Pinot reports from Paris.
The gesture coincided with mounting international pressure on the military junta in preparations for celebratory rallies in the capital Bamako, following the latest putsch in the troubled country. The UN peacekeeping mission in Mali, known as MINUSMA, said it dispatched a delegation for the military's headquarters at Kati, 10 miles from the capital, last night, in the framework of its mandate to protect human rights. The group was able to gain access to President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita, who resigned and dissolved parliament after he was detained and orders being held by the military. The junta announced the release of former economy minister Abdoulaye Dafe and Saban Mahamoudou, Keita's private secretary. 17 people are still detained. Mass rallies are scheduled for today to celebrate what many sees as a victory of the people. Protests demanding that Keita step down had been going on for months. The international community has strongly condemned the coup in the fragile Sahel state and demanding the detained leaders be freed. Nicolas Pinel, VOA News, Paris.
The military coup that ousted Mali's President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita has broad implications for the region and potentially for the West's relationship with West Africa and the continent as a whole. Amid international condemnation, the coup's leaders have promised fair elections and a swift return to civilian rule. In the short term, however, these events will also almost certainly further undermine stability in Mali itself, already reeling from economic woes and a bloody extremist insurgency. VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with John Campbell, the Ralph Bunche Senior Fellow for Africa Policy Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations in Washington, D.C. The former ambassador to Nigeria downplayed the impact that American protestations will have on a resolution to the crisis.
I don't think we have very much leverage over what's going on in Mali. We have a drone base in Niger. We provide certain logistical support for French forces that are operating in the Sahel. But so far as I know, we have no boots on the ground. I think we should be forthright in condemning what happened as a coup. But beyond that, I don't really, as a practical matter, see what the United States can do that will much influence the trajectory of events there.
The Western power that does have lots of leverage, of course, is France. It has 5,000 troops stationed in West Africa.
And I think we should all be watching very carefully the French reaction. The French government issued a statement denouncing the coup, but the French are ambiguous about this. Traditionally, the French view has been that the Sahel, including Mali, is the French equivalent of the near abroad. In other words, an area close to France and as such of primary concern to French security. Hence, 5,000 French troops in West Africa. The French public are concerned that the Sahel, including Mali, is becoming the Afghanistan of France. In other words, a conflict from which it's becoming impossible to extricate oneself. So I think the public view would tend to rein in any government interest in becoming more militarily involved, but not necessarily less militarily involved. So I would not anticipate, at least in the short term, any kind of French withdrawal from the Sahel. So what the French reaction is going to be beyond simple condemnation remains to be seen.
How do you think this French ambiguity and the international condemnation will actually play out?
It seems to me the most likely scenario is that the Malian military will announce that they are establishing an interim civilian government, ostensibly civilian, the military will control it, and that the job of this interim government will be to organize elections. And those steps will be broadly satisfactory to the international community, even though in terms of most Malians, it won't mean very much.
And to make the situation even more complicated, Mali has been plagued in recent years by an extremist insurgency. The deposed government's inability to bring them to heel was a major reason for the mass demonstrations that helped do it in. But there's now an even deeper political instability in the country as a result of the coup. That must be great news for the extremists.
I think that's exactly right. And what this does is it illustrates the secular government of Mali's inability to really function. And that makes the alternative that the Islamists are proposing more attractive.
What do you think is the real motivation of the military men who conducted the coup? I mean, they must have realized that this would mean more instability for Mali. Do you think some of those military leaders might actually have an interest in keeping the war with the extremists going for a while?
Some of them probably do, and some of them are probably making a fair amount of money out of it. But in terms of a broader motivation, I think there was a general fatigue with the instability, with the daily demonstrations, the threat of strikes that actually led to the arrest of the president. So too was the prime minister, so too was the minister of finance, so too was the head of the National Assembly. And the press says others have been arrested as well, but we don't know who they are.
That was John Campbell of the Council on Foreign Relations in Washington, speaking with VOA's Adam Phillips. South Africa's fight against COVID-19 could be heading for paralysis after a workers' union representing thousands of health care workers announced a series of protests actions that will culminate in a full-blown strike. The union is accusing the government of failing to provide health care workers with enough person protective equipment while allowing millions of dollars in COVID-19 funds to be looted through corruption. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
The National Education, Health and Allied Workers Union, with more than 274,000 members, has vowed to withdraw its members from their workstations until the government guarantees their protection from contracting the coronavirus. Zola Sipeta is the union's general secretary.
Whose lives must we lose? We can't protect the lives of the frontline workers. Instruments that are required and necessary for them to protect their lives are not provided.
The National Health Laboratory Services workers were the first to kickstart the protests with lunch pickets held across the country. These are essential in the fighting against COVID-19 since they carry out the tests for the virus. Others, including nurses and doctors, are expected to do the same starting Monday. A stay-away strike is planned for next week, Friday. Labor expert Andrew Levy says a strike is the last thing the country needs right now.
We all know that nurses and the like are exposed to risky conditions. One tries to minimize those. But nevertheless, in a manner of speaking, this is a matter of choice. They decided to go into that industry, and because of that, you accept a degree of risk.
However, Sapeta says they have engaged all relevant government departments, but it has been all talk and no action. He says the series of protests are only warning shots.
If there's nothing coming positive or favorable to our demands, it will be unfortunate. On the 10th September, we'll have to withdraw our labor completely.
He also accuses the government of failing to pay workers the agreed year salary increase that was due at the end of April. The workers are also angry that millions of dollars of COVID-19 funds have been looted by greedy officials and companies, leaving them exposed to the virus. The union says up to 27,000 health workers have contracted the coronavirus, while up to 180 have died, mainly due to lack of protective equipment. The government insists it is doing all it can to make sure health workers are well resourced. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
South Africa's military ombudsman has ruled that soldiers who allegedly beat a man to death for supposedly violating COVID lockdown rules in April acted outside their mandate. The ruling opens a path for a group of soldiers and officers from the Johannesburg Metro Police Department, or JMPD, to be charged in the death of a 40-year-old Collins Khosa in Alexandra Township. Darren Taylor reports.
A military report initially exonerated the soldiers. It suggested Collins Khosa had an underlying health problem that claimed his life. It also said he provoked the soldiers, who accused him of breaking lockdown regulations by drinking beer with a friend in his yard and insulting a female police officer. Defense Minister Nosiviwe Mapisa-Nqakula, who had vigorously defended the soldiers and police officers, says the ombudsman has dismissed the military report.
The ombuds concluded that the official conduct of these members was improper, irregular, and in contravention of the code of conduct, operational order, and rules of engagement.
The Khosa family's lawyer, Vikas Stale, says four soldiers and a few more police members were involved in Collins's death.
I understand that they are still on suspension, specifically the soldiers and the officers from JMPD. I don't know if they've been subjected to any internal disciplinary processes as yet, but I take note of the minister's comments that the soldiers are not off the hook and that she will continue against them.
The police department says its investigation is continuing, but Stale says based on how it's gone so far, his clients don't trust it.
Investigators did not even interview the family members. They only interviewed the soldiers and relied on statements previously provided by the family members to SAPS. And
the victim's family is also questioning why the probe is taking so long, given that a bystander recorded the incident on a cell phone.
The family cannot believe it and they cannot accept it when they saw with their own eyes what happened on the day. The family, they're traumatized. They're not doing well. Collins was severely assaulted and beaten by the soldiers with guns and shamboks and with a metal gate. Beer was poured over his head. Now for the SNP.
Opposition party leaders such as the Freedom Front Plus's Pieter Groenewald claim South African National Defense Force, or SANDF, leaders are partly to blame for Khosa's death.
The chief of the SANDF appeared on national television and he said, when the SANDF moves in, it is skop and klap.
Skop and klap are Afrikaans words meaning kick and hit.
Now, he set the example and that is exactly what these soldiers did. They skopped and klapped Collins Khosa.
Steyl says the COVID lockdown has exposed South African security forces' general brutality and poor training.
I've got clients coming to me 2-3 times a week with new instructions of being assaulted by soldiers and JNPD. It's clear that they are out of control, regardless of the code of conduct. They just simply ignore the code, ignore the laws, and ignore the constitution and believe they can do as
the government insists there are only a few bad apples in the police and army, and that what happened to Collins Khoza is an isolated incident. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Ethiopia arrested thousands of protesters, opposition members, and journalists during July's sectarian unrest. Health workers and local officials say some of those detained have contracted COVID-19 and are concerned the virus is spreading in overcrowded prisons and makeshift detention centers. Simon Marks reports from Zuwai, Ethiopia.
In the 4 months since Ethiopia recorded its first case of COVID-19, Dambal Kasim, the head nurse at a coronavirus treatment center in the Ethiopian town of Zuwai, had very little to do. But in the aftermath of widespread unrest following the killing of Hachilu Hundessa, a popular singer who fought for Ethiopia's Oromo ethnic group, things have become much busier. The unrest resulted in thousands of incarcerations and at least 178 deaths. Dambal, other health workers in the region and local officials say some detainees have tested positive for the coronavirus. Authorities are now testing inmates amid concerns the virus is spreading fast. Dambal spoke to VOA in an interview where he said that in the 3 months since COVID-19 began, he had only seen 2 cases of the coronavirus, but in the last 2 weeks, he's recorded 23. In prisons, there are sometimes 150 people in one room, he said, following the unrest. Rights workers say Ethiopian authorities have detained scores of opposition members and journalists for prolonged periods without charges since Hachilu's death on June 28. The result is overcrowded jail and makeshift detention centres located inside schools and warehouses. While the government has blamed the opposition Tigray People's Liberation Party for coordinating the killing and the violence that followed Hachilu's death, anti-government activists and Oromo opposition members believe the violence was planned to create the conditions necessary to clamp down on dissent. Jibril Sharbi, the CEO of the General Hospital in Zuwai, spoke with VOA about the risk of COVID-19 spreading among detainees. He said that following the arrests after Hachilu was killed, he had recorded more cases. He also said there had been 3 female prisoners infected and sent to a nearby town. Among those detained who have contracted COVID-19 is Kenyan journalist Yasin Yuma. The Foreign Correspondents Association of East Africa has complained that he was held despite the court granting him bail and have appealed for his immediate release. On Thursday, he was sent to a government-run isolation center. The Ethiopian Health Ministry did not respond to questions asking how many detainees had contracted COVID-19. Simon Marks for VOA News, Zuwai, Ethiopia.
Several Gambian women who were trafficked to Lebanon and sold for cheap labor are appealing to the Gambian government for help returning home. Many women have been trafficked to Lebanon, Kuwait, Qatar, and other parts of the Gulf, where they say they often are forced to work for long hours, sometimes denied food, and often are not paid. Reporter Panderam Bai reports from Raleigh, North Carolina.
She goes by the name Mariama, and she hails from a Gambian village called Pira. She was trafficked to Lebanon back in 2016. She says her passport was confiscated from her upon arrival at the Lebanon airport. She arrived there at night and was escorted to the mountains in the countryside to the home of her trafficker's mother. Speaking the Mandinka language, Mariama says she left her child behind in the Gambia to search for employment overseas. She had briefly attended Arabic school, but later dropped out and has no other education. She also cannot speak any foreign languages. She started working the day she arrived in Lebanon, and she refers to those who purchased her work contract as her slave masters. In its annual report on human trafficking, the U.S. government this year upgraded the Gambia to Tier 2 from Tier 3. It notes that although the country has been working to combat trafficking, the government has not convicted a single trafficker for the third consecutive year. Victim services remain inadequate, and some law enforcement officers allegedly requested bribes to register trafficking complaints. Mariama says she was at the mercy of the woman who purchased her from the trafficker, and that she was denied access to any form of communication. She says upon arrival, she decided to hide her Gambian cell phone so that she could use it to communicate with her family back home. But she says the cell phone was later seized by her owner's husband. She was told she was not supposed to use the phone and that she was supposed to walk all day long without any outside communication. She pleaded with her slave master, but was only allowed to use the phone once a week. She says she later was permanently denied access to her cell phone. Mariama also says she wouldn't be allowed to eat for days and was often given leftovers to eat and often had only water to drink without any food. She once worked for 8 months without pay. Mariama worked in 4 different homes. She says Gambian women had been sold to Lebanese families for $2,000 for a 2-year forced labor contract. She says some of the women suffer from beatings or other cruel treatment. She says she later ran away from a family that had purchased her. She couldn't put up with the forced labor and the lack of food to eat. She was sheltered by an Ethiopian who later helped her to reach the Gambian community in Lebanon. Mariama has rented an apartment with 5 other escaped women. She now earns a living by hair braiding. She says life is hard in Lebanon and they struggle to pay their bills. She appeals to the Gambian government to help repatriate them. Fatou Diagne was trafficked from the Gambia to Kuwait. She now runs an organization called Network of Girls Against Human Trafficking.
As I am talking to you, I don't even know what to do now because I am receiving calls every day from these young people. Not only in Gambia, but they are in different African countries, Nigeria, Ghana, Ethiopia, asking for help, asking for me to come out and talk to their government, talk to their people so that they can help them to repatriate them to come back to Africa because they are really suffering. They are killing them. They are abusing them. They are raping them. They are torturing them.
Fatou returned to the Gambia in 2017. She told VOA she never knew that she was sold as a slave until the man who bought her told her and said she had no rights. Fatou is pushing the Gambian government to help evacuate the trafficked Gambian women in the Arab world, but says so far nothing has been done. Foreign Ministry spokesman Sekou Cisse says efforts are underway to return stranded trafficking victims from Lebanon, but as yet there is not clear timeline as to when it will happen. He also says the government is committed to fighting human trafficking. For VOA News, this is Pan Dirimbay reporting from Raleigh, North Carolina.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the Sunny Side of Sports, Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/Sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.